Ready?
Yep, we're ready.
Okay. Peace and blessings, everyone. I'm Aziza, and welcome to episode number 16 of Hot Tea. Today, we're going to discuss something that is very controversial, a topic that evokes intense emotion and ridicule if dissenting views are expressed. The events of September 11th, 2001, sent America, and in many cases, the world, on a path in which there has been no turning back. My special guest, 9/11 whistleblower and retired United Airlines captain, Dan Hanley, has over 30 years of experience flying commercial aircraft. Captain Hanley currently serves as the director and international public spokesperson of a global grassroots effort called 9/11 Pilot Whistleblowers. Captain Hanley, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, and thank you for having me. Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me on the program, Aziza.
Absolutely.
I suppose I could start out, since most people don't, nobody knows who I am, giving a brief introduction as to who I am. I was a pilot, as you mentioned, for 35 years in my working life, both as a U.S. Naval Aviator and United Airlines pilot. I'm a Muslim American citizen married to a Muslim Pakistani. We currently reside in Islamabad, Pakistan, where we've lived for the past 4 years. So I commenced flying over 50 years ago in 1968. First as a civilian flying light aircraft. I was in a community college in my hometown, and my parents didn't have any money, so I had to work the worst jobs in the world to pay for my flying. But I was successful in acquiring my private commercial instrument and multi-engine rating by 1970. And then I went on to a four-year college, Southern Illinois University, where I got a math degree. And when I graduated in 1973, the Vietnam War was raging, so I had to make service plans or get inducted into the Army. So I chose naval aviation. And I flew three training aircraft in the training command, but over a period of 10 years, cumulative, I flew the P-3 Orion aircraft, which was used to track Soviet submarines during the Cold War. In 1978, I was hired by United Airlines as a pilot. And over the course of the next 25 years, I flew 15 different aircraft, accruing over a total of 20,000 flight hours in my career. You mentioned I currently serve as the director and international public spokesperson for that global grassroots effort called Pilots 9/11 Pilot Whistleblowers. Well, we have a website at 911pilots.org. If you want to reference that, I'll be referring to that throughout this interview. And we also have a YouTube channel at 911 Pilots. The purpose of the organization is to show that there were no Muslim hijackers at the controls of the 9/11 aircraft, but that these aircraft were electronically hijacked through employment of a system called the uninterruptible autopilot that enables a remote source to take complete control of the aircraft's autopilot and flight management computers and fly the aircraft to the targets. Now, once this system is engaged, the pilots can no longer disconnected. They're along for the ride. So we're claiming that they were remotely controlled, and the hijackers had no control of the aircraft. And I'll make this one statement. With all my experience as a pilot, I can unequivocally say, without embarrassment or reservation, that I could not have flown the 9/11 flight profiles at those speeds and altitudes, and neither could the hijackers.
Captain Hanley. Wow. So I want to start off with this before I get into the sophistication of a large commercial airliner and the supposed qualifications of said hijackers. Can you walk us through what you were doing that day?
Okay, then I was a Boeing 777 captain out of New York, and I'd flown into Newark Airport the night before. There were thunderstorms in the area. I almost had to divert, but that was a cold front that cleared the air out that day. I fell asleep and slept through the entire ordeal. Woke up after all the buildings had collapsed and the plane crashed in Shanksville. And like everybody else, I was pretty shocked, thinking we were under attack. And I had friends telling me to get out of New York on the phone. It's dangerous there. And I was thrown out of my hotel room while starting this up, because they had already reserved it for someone else. And I heard all the flights were grounded, so I managed to make my way over to the Newark Airport because I heard that's where United Flight 93 departed from, and I thought maybe I could render some assistance there. So I was in my uniform, I had my ID card, and they had snow removal equipment blocking the exit ramps, but I managed to get in, and I spent the day at the Newark Airport along with pilots who had actually met the captain of and the co-pilot of United 93 that morning and walked up to the gate with them, and they were being held by the FBI for questioning. So we waited till about 6 at night, and they wanted to reserve us a hotel room, but I decided I was going to go back to Atlanta, which is where I lived at the time. I was a commuter, so I caught an all-night train ride home. But I still believe, looking at those smoldering buildings, that we were under attack. I never really didn't give much thought to how the building came down symmetrically or that we're dustified. And as time went on, I began to disbelieve the official story. I started seeing huge holes in the aviation safety and security system, and airline managers and the government were telling people to get on airplanes. The system was safe, and I knew otherwise. So I started, I was flying with out of Newark mainly with a bunch of scared flight attendants and pilots because they thought we were going to get hijacked again and saw there were no security systems in place. And they were asking me to say something. I'll give you an example. We were promised cameras in the back of the airplane, secondary barrier protection, federal air marshals and the like. And none of that was happening. So I began reporting it to my flight manager at JFK and my union officials. And then I started a correspondence trail because I was getting blowback. They were telling me, watch it, Dan, these guys are nasty. If you take it to the next level, you're going to get hurt. The company thinks you're a big mouth, loose cannon whistleblower. Because what I was reporting was actually showing that the aviation security system was a farce. Well, it wasn't until they came out with the flight experience or lack thereof of the hijackers that with my experience both in light airplanes and I had flown the 757 and 767, I knew with the complexities of the aircraft and the differences that they couldn't possibly have flown those aircraft and flight profiles with their limited experience. And that I wasn't reporting that part, but that's what did it for me. And over the course of about 9 months, this continued until finally all my reports were internal to the company. And when I kept getting stonewalled by the company and the union told me they wouldn't follow me very far in on this. So I filed a report called the Flight Safety Awareness Report that brought the Federal Aviation Administration in. And once I did that, I was immediately removed from the flight schedule without cause. So I called my chief pilot. I was trying to make arrangements to have a meeting and bring my attorneys in because my union wasn't representing me and they wouldn't allow it. I called company lawyers. They were at an impasse with me. So I was still getting paid at the time, but I was taken out of schedule and they wouldn't arrange meetings with me. So shortly thereafter, my chief pilot from New York calls me and tells me, I talked with the chief flight surgeon at United out in Denver, and he said, put that expletive deleted on sick list. So he says, I'm sorry, Dan, my hands are tied on this one. So I had been warned that this could happen, and I saw it happen to other pilots. What they try to do is ground you professionally, medically, psychologically, or otherwise for life. And I'd never failed a check ride in my life professionally. Medically, I never failed a flight physical. So I thought perhaps they were going to go after me psychologically. So what I was living in Atlanta at the time, what I did was hire the best mental health professionals in the Atlanta area and say, here's where I am. Here's what they're going to try to do to me. Screen me psychologically so I can defend myself. I've already got a correspondence trail. I've been recording phone conversations and the like. So I was going to follow it through on this. So that's what I did for several months. And no, I'm not insane. I've gone on programs and people say, I'm glad he's not flying airplanes anymore. I can verify that I'm not. what they wound up doing was, and I'll shorten this up because I don't know how much time we have on the program, but what they wound up doing was insist that I enter the employee assistance program. Now that program designed for employees that have financial problems, drug problems, alcohol problems, or anything else that would distract them on the job. And in doing so, you have to abide by the company or the union request. It's endorsed by the Federal Aviation Administration, the company and the union. So I agreed to do that. And the first thing they said was, we want to fly you up to Chicago for you to see the flight surgeon there, which I had to go along, so I agreed to do that. So I flew up to Chicago, went over to the office, and the first thing Dr. McGovern says to me is, are you seeing a mental health professional? And I said, well, I thought you would ask that. Yes, as a matter of fact, I am. Would you like to talk to him? And I whipped out my cell phone and handed him my doctor. And there were several people in the office at the time. And he got off the phone and he said, would you be willing to go over and see our mental health professional? And I agreed. And two pilots drove me over to what I thought was an office, and it turned out to be a mental institution. And I was admitted, and I went along with it because I wanted to see how far they'd go with this. So when they admitted me, actually they took me in an office and I talked with a Catholic nun who was a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. And we talked for about an hour, and I saw I wasn't getting through to her regarding the complexities of aviation safety and reporting systems and the like. So she said, it was late in the day and I'd gotten up real early, and she said, listen, the company wants to see you to see a psychiatrist. would you like to stay here for the night? We can make arrangements. You can see one the first thing in the morning and be out of here. Well, I was tired and I thought, well, I'd have to cab it out to a hotel and back in the morning. So I agreed, thinking I was just gonna get a private room. And I didn't realize what kind of a facility it was. I'd just seen the check-in desk in this office I was in. So I was escorted upstairs by this nun and the two pilots. And the first clue I had was we walked in and they locked the door behind me. They took my shoes, my belt, and all my personal belongings, escorted me down the hall to a co-ed wing, telling me along the way, make sure you check under your bed and beneath under your bed and in the bathroom in the night, because the female patients tried to molest male patients. And I said, well, I'll lock my door. And they said, well, you can't. And I thought, what have I gotten myself into here? So they once I got settled in the room, I was in the room with a paranoid schizophrenic man, I learned later. They said, we want you to come down the hall and take medication. I said, I don't need anything. You know, well, you needed to sleep. I said, no, I'm tired. And, well, they insisted. So I thought, okay, go along with the program. So I went down, stood in line like one flew over the cuckoo's nest, and had to take the pill in front of them. And they took me back to the room. And about 4 a.m. in the morning, I was in the dark. The only light coming in the room was from the hallway. And I was surrounded by nurses and a doctor with my blood pressure 60 over 40 and a huge weld on the side of my face, where I had fallen. I don't know what kind of medication it was, but they got me back in bed. Then I start getting paranoid, what's going on here? So they sent me for a physical first thing in the morning, I think, to protect themselves. But I didn't see a psychiatrist the next day. They wanted to run tests on me. So I took the same psychological profile test I'd taken with my mental health professionals in Atlanta, a Myers-Briggs and a few other tests, and nothing showed up there. So I took those, but I was forced to dine with these very mentally ill patients and go to group therapy sessions with them. So it was very, for me, demeaning. I thought, what am I doing here, right? So finally, the third day, I meet with the psychiatrist, and we only were in the room about 10 or 15 minutes. And we had a congenial conversation, nothing aberrant about my behavior. And I said, well, doctor, what's your diagnosis going to be? She says, I'm going to say you're bipolar. And I chuckled and I said, well, I have two mental health professionals in Atlanta that beg to differ with your diagnosis, so I'll take it up with them. Release me from here because I'm not going to participate in this program anymore, which she did. Well, when I got out, the skids were already greased. The hospital had already talked to the Alpha Aeromedical Consultant, the psychiatrist in Denver, the union, the company, and the FAA. And they had me out of there. So I thought, okay, I'll fight this on the outside and I'll wind it up with this. I spent 5 years of my life. I filed an FAA whistleblower protection report. I spent 5 years of my life taking my case to all levels and branches of the U.S. government without success. I was stonewalled at every turn, and they wound up in 2000, I can't remember what year it was, closing my case without interviewing a single witness or reviewing any of the solid evidence that I had or testimony. I had some other pilots. So all in all, it destroyed a 27-year marriage. It alienated my two adult children who blame me for the divorce, still believe the official 9/11 story and think I'm a whacked out conspiracy nut and don't talk to me. It ruined my career and my reputation, and I lost about $4 million in pay pension and stock. So that's essentially what happened from September 11th up until about 2011.
So to summarize, they ruined you for speaking the truth.
Exactly. And I was on a, subsequently, I was on a radio program called Medical Whistleblower. And this doctor that hosted me on the program told me that bipolar disorder was the most common diagnosis that they give in instances like this, because it's so hard to disprove once diagnosed. So, and it's not just prevalent in the airline industry. It's across all industries and all branches of government. And I always cited an example of Russell Pice. People don't know who he was, but everyone knows who Edward Snowden is. And Russell Pice was the first NSA whistleblower and who was exposing NSA wiretaps. And he leaked the story to the New York Times, and NSA discovered that he was the source. So he ran before Congress and testified, but unlike Snowden, he didn't have the goods to back his assertion. So the NSA pulled him back to the job and put him in charge of the motor pool. Now, mind you, this is a 20-year plus military civilian intelligence officer. Put him in charge of the motor pool until they could find a psychiatrist that would diagnose him as mentally unstable, and they fired him from the job when they pulled his security clearance. So it's very common. This is how they silence you. And what that winds up doing is sending out a chilling signal to any other would-be employee who might contemplate blowing the whistle on anything. So it has a devastating impact on this whistleblower.
Right. They made an example of you. And yes, these supposed doctors, you know, do no harm. They probably received orders from someone above them.
Of course.
You know, to misdiagnose you. Because it, from what you tell me, it sounds like they wanted to keep you long term.
Right, right. I learned later that if you willingly submit to a mental institution in the state of Illinois, they can hold you up to 5 days against your will. So yeah. I got out in 3. I told them I wasn't going to cooperate. So, yeah.
So, because I've heard a lot of different theories surrounding 9/11. Nanothermite, HAARP, controlled demolition. What makes this inoperable mechanism on an aircraft, you know, the smoking gun with all of this, do you think? Is it possible that there could be more than one? Does it have to be either or can it be both and for these different theories?
Either one or both and of what? Theory? Oh, let me just point out.
Controlled demolition, could it be that? And could it also be the inoperable mechanism on aircraft?
Both. They're disjoint cases, and I can get into the lawyer's committee in just a little while. They're dealing with controlled demolition of the buildings, where we're not saying what happened on 9/11 with regard to the hijackers of the past. We're saying what could not have happened, and that is they didn't have the experience to fly the aircraft. And when you say there were no Muslim hijackers at the controls of the 9/11 aircraft, that blows the heck out of the official narrative.
Oh, yeah.
That says there were no Muslims involved. And that opens up a whole can of worms for the government to explain.
Right.
I'll give you an example of one thing they need to explain. Oh, the speed of the aircraft.
I'm sorry, Tara, did you have a question?
No, I'll wait till you finish. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was wondering about the flight hours, because remember they were saying they had all these flight hours that they had took. They took the flight hours right here on, you know, U.S. soil. So you're saying right, based on the aircraft that they were flying, there's no way, you know, they would even be able to have that experience. I don't know how many flight hours you need, but.
Well, they all have a commercial license, and everybody says, well, that should suffice. Well, that only requires 250 hours of flying time if you go to a FAA-approved school. To get a rating on an aircraft, a commercial jet aircraft, just to apply for it, you have to have a minimum of 1,500 hours, which gives you an idea of the experience level expected of someone flying those airplanes. So these guys only had a few hundred hours, and we target Hani Hanjour, who was a 29-year-old Saudi Arabian hijacker who allegedly hijacked American 77 that flew into the Pentagon. He came to the States in the mid-90s and took some flight training before returning to Saudi Arabia. And he came back in January 2001 and went to reapply to the same flight school in Arizona, and they refused to accept it because he was such a poor pilot when he was there before. And then you jump ahead to August 2001, a month prior to 9/11. He tried to run a single engine Cessna 172 from the freeway airport in Maryland, and they refused to run it to him because he couldn't handle the aircraft. He couldn't take off and land or fly the aircraft. So this guy supposedly hijacked the airplane out west of the Pentagon, did a U-turn, headed back in and then descended at 7,000 feet. He commences this descending and accelerating 330-degree corkscrew turn to arrive precisely at ground level without skidding the surface to hit the Office of Naval Intelligence at nearly 500 miles an hour, over 500 miles an hour. Now, this profile was replicated in a simulator by a group of pilots from Pilots for 9/11 Truth. And almost without exception, every time they attempted to perform the maneuver, they crashed the simulator. And these guys were highly experienced, with the one exception being a pilot who managed to hit the building on his 20th attempt. And yet we're led to believe that this guy flew that aircraft that day. And you got to note that all three buildings were hit with military precision on their first attempt. And you say, well, they were big buildings, the Twin Towers. Well, not necessarily. You look at what the precision required. Had they been a few degrees off heading, they would have missed the building entirely. And at that closure rate on the building at over 500 miles per hour, you have to make snap judgments in close. And I use the analogy, it's not original, but imagine if you had your license in a car for a year and you were asked to get into a large semi-tractor trailer truck and accelerate it to 500 miles per hour and try to drive it through a jiffy loop or a garage without scraping the sides of the truck. That's how accurate they had to be, and all three of them were. And we contend that with their lack of experience, they couldn't have done that.
So, Captain Dan, if it wasn't Muslim hijackers, who was it and why?
Well, we contend that the only logical and reasonable explanation we can give as to how these airplanes hit the target was the uninterruptible autopilot system. If anybody else can come up with a better explanation as to how, we know three planes hit the building, okay. We know these hijackers couldn't possibly have flown them. I've interviewed pilots from around the world on camera who assert the same thing that I do. So who could have been involved? Some of the most powerful people in the world. You look at over 190 countries in the world, and all the world leaders remain silent, and they have access to the same information that we do. There are those, including myself, who believe that there were Israeli Zionist elements along with working with Mossad in collusion with neocon Zionist elements in the CIA and elsewhere who planned and executed the events of 9/11. Now, others have done research, and I've read it, that it includes other countries as well. But what would be their motive for doing that? Are you familiar with the Greater Israel Project?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, for those of you who aren't, the Greater Israel Project is a Zionist political ideology in Israel that contends that the biblical promised land extends from the Euphrates to the Nile River. And if you look at the countries that encompasses, and you look at the governments that were destabilized in the Middle East as a result of the illegal and unwarranted invasions in those countries that killed, maimed, or displaced millions of Muslims on a crime they didn't commit. That would be the motive for Israel to have enjoined the United States. And if you look at the United States and its designs on global domination, and you look at the $6.2 trillion that was spent, that a lot went to defense contractors, a lot of people stood to make a lot of money from the events of 9/11. So I can't prove anything on what I just said. And people say, you just said Zionist, you're an anti-Semite. Well, then they don't realize the difference between the two terms. So I suggest you look that up. I'm not anti-Semitic. I honor and respect all world religions, and I have nothing against Jews whatsoever. So I just am opposed to the Zionist ideology, because if you look at, I could go into some other things if you'd like. People don't realize what the American Israel Public Affairs Committee is, APAC, and the stranglehold it has on all levels and branches of the U.S. government. I mean, no one dares in Congress speak out, utter a word against Israel. I mean, Ilhan Omar proved that. Congressman Cynthia McKinney proved it, and the late James Traficant congressman proved that by speaking out, even uttering a syllable against Israel. So, and when you look at their stranglehold that they have on the government, as well as the media complicity in perpetuating this lie for over 20 years, you go back to 1983. In 1983 in the United States, there were over 50 independent media outlets reporting. And today, there are only six major media conglomerates that have been infiltrated at all levels and branches by Zionists. You can look it up on the internet and you'll see who sits in what position in these media conglomerates. When you go back to 1983, Israel launched Operation Hasbara, whose design was to infiltrate U.S. media, or actually influence U.S. media into casting a favorable light on Israel. So when you look, you never hear anyone raising an eyebrow about Israel on the media. So I look at this complicity between governments, intelligence agencies, the media that's perpetuated the story, and the lobby that has a stranglehold on government officials in the United States. And I put that all together and come to my own conclusions about who is responsible for 9/11.
Absolutely. And for me, you know, just from a common sense perspective, if you just analyze the official story, it does not pass the smell test. You know, right. You're telling me that the black box in these aircrafts was melted, but, you know, these passports are intact. You know, right. There's eyewitnesses who saw Muhammad Atta at strip clubs, you know, right. doing lines of cocaine and drinking and whatnot, you know, rolls of cash.
Right. Well, if you just look at the official story that says that Osama bin Laden, living in a cave somewhere in the mountainous regions of Afghanistan on dialysis, suffering from kidney failure, armed with a laptop and a satellite phone, managed to command 19 angry hijackers to commandeer 4 commercial jet aircraft, evade the most sophisticated air defense system in the world for over an hour, and crash 3 or 4 of the building aircraft into building. I mean, the story itself is ridiculous.
Oh, absolutely.
It's absurd.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, with my experience in the military, I know for a fact that if there is any unidentified aircraft in U.S. airspace, if you don't respond within a short amount of time, you are shot down.
Right, right.
So, I mean, just that within and of itself does not make sense why these aircraft were allowed to keep flying.
And then you look at bin Laden himself. In April 2006, there was an FBI public spokesperson by the name of Rex Toombs who was conducting a news conference. And it was pointed out that Osama bin Laden was not on the FBI most wanted list for the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, but was not on there for the crimes of 9/11. And when they asked him that question, his response was, quote, "The FBI has no hard evidence connecting Osama bin Laden to the crimes to 9/11, unquote. So they had no evidence on the guy. And yet, several years ago, just up the road from here in Pakistan, they potentially extrajudicially murdered an innocent man for a crime he did not commit. So that's what I call an extrajudicial murder, because he wasn't entitled to a trial by jury or anything that entails. So,
yeah, and there was an article, I don't know if it was in like 2003, but it was a couple of years after 9/11. It was from a Middle Eastern newspaper where I think it was 12 or 17 of the hijackers were like, "Hey, I'm still alive."
Wow. Right.
Yeah, you used to be able to find it. I haven't looked for it in a few years, so I don't know if it's still floating out there. But yeah, they were like, my name and my picture and my likeness were being used for this, connected to this. I'm still alive. Yeah. This was not me.
Yeah, yeah. So
what about the insurance that was taken out by the gentleman who owned the Twin Towers? Was it about like a week before it happened?
It was 4 months before it happened. He leased out the entire World Trade Center complex. He owned, his name was Larry Silverstein, personal friend of Benjamin Netanyahu, talked to him once a week, was supposed to be up having breakfast every morning with his family at the Windows on the World on top of the World Trade Center, and just happened to have a dermatology meeting that morning, appointment that morning, and missed the appointment. His kids didn't show up there. So yes, he did take out a $10 billion insurance policy on the entire complex, including damage by a terrorist attack.
Yes, and that's what.
after 9/11, he collected $4.2 billion in insurance money on buildings that were scheduled to come down anyhow, because they were loaded with asbestos. They were white elephants. They were ancient buildings that the city of New York wanted down, but they couldn't figure a way of bringing them down without all these people ingesting asbestos fibers that was packed in the building, and it would have cost millions of dollars to remove the asbestos. So 9/11 did them the favor of bringing the buildings down. And all those firemen that were down there working in the area, look at the hundreds that have died of
cancer
and other related illnesses. So it was totally unsafe them working down there.
Captain Dan. So if it's loaded with asbestos, were they also scared that if somebody finds that out, they could be literally sued by all the people that have been working there? You know what I mean? With the asbestos there and them not notifying people that it is loaded with asbestos and they've been breathing.
Yeah, they could have reported it. But it was the building wasn't even wired for Wi-Fi or anything else. It was two antique white elephants in New York City, and they couldn't figure out how to bring them down. And if you look at, if we go to World Trade Center Building 7, a lot of people don't realize that a third building collapsed on 9/11. It was called the Solomon Brothers Building, and Larry Silverstein actually owned that building. And at 5:20 in the afternoon of 9/11, there were a few office fires raging in the building. I'll point something else out. Ever in the history, a steel-reinforced concrete building, high-rise skyscrapers, has any ever collapsed due to a fire? And on 9/11, three of them did. So the third building, Building 7, at 5:20 in the afternoon, with a few office fires that were being brought under control, Larry Silverstein, he's on tape saying this, he gave the order to pull it. Now, that's a term used in controlled demolition, bring the building down. So the building came collapsing down in its own footprint in less than 7 seconds at near the acceleration rate due to gravity to a pile of rubble that was less than one story tall. And you say, so what's the problem there? Well, that a 47-story building like that, it would take weeks, if not months, to pre-warp or controlled demolition. So It was a controlled demolition, and that brings up the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 inquiry. And if I could preface that by talking about the goal of 9/11 pilot whistleblowers.
Go ahead.
Our goal is to recruit highly trained and experienced military and civilian pilots from around the world who will back my assertion, our assertion, that the hijackers couldn't have flown the aircraft. And what we're doing is filming interviews, forwarding it to this Lawyers Committee in hopes of getting our case before a federal grand jury in New York. Now, what the Lawyers Committee is comprised of is a group of highly experienced lawyers in the United States who got together with the most experienced, most famous 9/11 whistleblowers in the world that have all this information. And they compiled 57 evidence packages and presented it to the U.S. attorney in New York and forced him to convene a grand jury investigation into their allegation that all three buildings were brought down by controlled demolition. Now, I'm working personally with the chairman and the chief litigator for the Lawyers Committee. They know what we're doing. They don't legally represent us at present, but that's the direction we're headed. And some of the organizations that have come forth with these evidence packages is an organization called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And Richard Gage, its founder, is a 20-year architect, and he's got 3,000 architects and engineers from around the world who have signed on demanding that a new investigation be conducted because it's structurally impossible for those buildings to have come down, for that concrete and steel to have dustified and come down in 11 seconds all the way to the surface, and both of them identically. Another group are the firemen who were in the building and heard explosions going off before the buildings came down and afterwards, okay? And then there's a gentleman named William Rodriguez. I'll make his story brief. He was a janitor in one of the stairwells in the World Trade Center. And there were six sub-basements in the Trade Center building, and he was in the middle one. And when the first plane hit, he ran upstairs because he had keys to the stairwell and let firemen in and guided him upstairs unlocking doors, and he helped bring people down until the building started to collapse. And he was the last man out of the building. They call him the last man out of the hero of 9/11 because he helped these people out. And he jumped under a truck as the building came down, and the passerby saw him jump under the truck and came back afterwards with rescue workers and got him out. Well, Bush caught wind of this fact of the hero of 9/11 and invited him to the White House and gave him a hero award. And he was surrounded by all these politicians who were telling him, hey, we're going to run you for political office. We got a movie deal, a book deal. He went to testify before committee, and they were asking him about the event impact. There was a huge explosion in the sub-basement beneath me. Well, all the fanfare dried up immediately. They all ran away from me. And William spent the last 20 years going around the world giving a talk about this experience. So we know there was an explosion also in the basement of the building before aircraft impact. So it's saying that I'm having network problems here. Can you both hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. It's in and out a little bit, but right now I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. It's saying your network bandwidth is low here. So the final thing I'll talk about, the twin towers, because we're getting off the topic of the pilot, is the melting iron. Jet fuel burns at a temperature of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you look, you saw the initial big fireball, that was the jet fuel being exhausted, and the subsequent black smoke that emanated from the building, that's indicative of an office fire that burns at about 300 or 400 degrees, okay? Steel melts at a temperature of 2750 Fahrenheit, okay? And yet, molten iron was seen pouring like lava out of the building prior to its collapse, and for months afterwards in the debris field where these firemen were walking around, they said it looked like lava flow or a steel foundry, the way this melted iron was flowing around the basement of the building. So a group of scientists got together, notably Dr. Niels Herod, a 42-year retired chemistry professor from the University of Copenhagen. And what they did was collect soil samples from the three debris fields of the collapsed building. and they were able to determine that a highly incendiary substance called nanothermite was found throughout the dust samples, and that burns at a temperature of 4,000 degrees. So there are many who believe, and this is part of the evidence packages that was presented to the U.S. Attorney in New York, there are many that believe that it was a controlled demolition.
Wow.
So you might ask me why at 71 years of age am I doing this, and why are other people around the world joining me in this crusade?
Yes, that was my next question.
As I mentioned, okay. It's because since 9/11, millions of Muslims and others have been killed, maimed, or displaced in the Middle East and South Asia for a crime that Muslims did not commit. Since 9/11, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, has been slandered. The Holy Quran's been desecrated. Islam has been demonized, and millions of Muslims have been persecuted for a crime they have not committed. Did not commit. So we're not doing this just for the 2,977 people that were killed in the United States on 9/11. We're doing it for all the slaughter that occurred thereafter based on lies. I personally know too much about 9/11 to remain silent, so that's why I continue to speak out.
I have to tell you, you know, this is a very noble cause.
Well, there's a lot of people behind me. I'm a public spokesperson for a group of people that have joined us since we started and launched our website. So if you go to our YouTube channel at 911 Pilots, there's a lot of videos on there that support everything that I'm saying here. On the government side, our organization, I personally filed an FAA whistleblower report with the Federal Aviation Administration. They acknowledged, sent me a receipt, put me in contact with an engineer in Seattle where we're contending that this uninterruptible autopilot was used. And right now, all indications are they're trying to stonewall us because we have irrefutable evidence. We've given them more than sufficient evidence to start an investigation into our allegations. So I went to the Department of Transportation Inspector General, Chief Compliance Officer, and said, hey, it looks like the FAA is stonewalling us because, well, I've been following your case because I've been copying them on emails. So that's the other side. And just last week, I sent to the Assistant Attorney General Criminal Division, the FBI Director, and FBI Atlanta an email asking them to join the FAA in this investigation. And they have not responded to it yet, but people don't realize that the 9/11 Commission did not constitute a criminal investigation. As a matter of fact, there's never been a criminal investigation into the crimes of 9/11, which is the biggest crime ever committed on American soil in its history. And I'll point out that not one pilot was permitted to testify before the 9/11 Commission as to the absurdity of this ludicrous notion that those pilots actually flew those aircraft. So,
yeah, that's
we're trying to force the criminal investigation.
That's their MO, you know, anytime that they're pulling a false flag or, you know, anything of that nature, they never will show anybody who has experience. The best way to is distract and, you know,
exactly
deter away from the facts. Because they'll lose against facts. So it's always going to be emotive arguments and, you know, deception.
Well, I contend that the reason the bulk of the global population fell for this official story that the hijackers flew the airplane is because they're not pilots and they cannot conceive of the absurdity of this notion that they actually flew the airplane. They cannot relate. They were told, we know who they are. We don't need to investigate. They had flight training, they had hours, they could fly the airplanes, but that's what our website at 911pilots.org points out, okay? And I'll just real quickly go through. It's a simple website to read. It's got a drop-down menu that takes you to a number of other pages on the website, and it's got a lot of informative videos on there that you really need to watch. But the first thing we look at is the airplane. You're talking about a Cessna 172, which is the primary flight training aircraft, weighed about a ton as compared to Thank you. You've got it up. As compared to the Boeing 757, 767s that weigh 100 tons, it'd be like driving a small car, like I mentioned before, compared to a large semi-tractor trailer truck. If you go to the cockpits on the website, you'll see that the Cessna 172 has a few round dial instruments that were used in back in when I was flying small airplanes. They got a few knobs and switches, and we contrast that to a photo of a Boeing 767 cockpit. Wow. And you look at the myriad of switches and instruments. You look at the flight instruments themselves, the CRT displays that have a wealth of information that they wouldn't have been able to interpret. But more importantly, there's two black squares that are on the center pedestal. They're flight management computers that have several pages of information and have a clue. And that's the primary navigation source for the aircraft. So to say that they were able to fly these airplanes, get in, interpret these flight instruments, and we say, do you notice any subtle differences? Well, of course you do. So if you go to the hijackers page on there, that's where we do give examples of their experience on the airplane. And we talk about Hani Han, high ringleader for the group, who hit the North Tower. An American, they hadn't flown a jet aircraft before in their life, and they hit the targets in their first attempt, flying at speeds of 500 miles per hour. So he had a he was the oldest of them all, and it was the slowest airplane of them all. But if you look at Marwan Al-Shehhi, he's from the United Arab Emirates. He flew United Flight 175 that allegedly crashed into the South Tower. He's only 23 years old. He hit that building at 590 miles per hour. Now, had if you look at the film of the airplane approaching it, 12 seconds out from the building, the aircraft rolls into a 30-degree angle of bank turn. And had he not made, had the aircraft not made that turn at precisely that point with that angle of bank, someone has computed that he would have missed the building by 800 feet. So it's a maneuver that even highly experienced pilots would have a difficult time performing. And finally, there's Hani Hanjour, the one I talked about before that allegedly hit the Pentagon. We target him because we have several notes on him just talking about the lack of experience the guy has. So just look at that page, look at their experience, look at the airplanes they were supposed to fly, and you ask yourself, could they have flown these airplanes? The next page on the website is our remote control page, which is the meat of the website. And people say, there is no way you can remotely control a large aircraft in flight. Well, actually,
oh, yes, remote control,
yes, remote control technology goes back at least 75 years ago to 1944, when the U.S. military launched Operation Aphrodite in Europe. And what they did was got out old B-24 bombers to lighten the weight of the aircraft and load it with 30,000 pounds of Torpex, which is a highly incendiary compound. And the pilots were required to make the takeoff, but once they got airborne, the pilots would bail out of the aircraft, and the aircraft would be remotely controlled to its target in Europe. Now, this was the first example of a military drone aircraft, and that was over 75 years ago. Now, we point out also that Joe Kennedy, JFK's older brother, was killed in one of these missions when the airplane blew up before he had a chance to bail out due to a malfunction. Now, if you jump ahead 40 years and imagine the exponential rise in technology over a 40-year span with the advent of the computer age, what NASA and the FAA did was a joint crash test experiment using a large four-engine Boeing 720 aircraft, commercial jet aircraft. And they didn't have any passengers or crew on board. It was loaded with crash dummies, and they wanted to test the crew and passenger survivability in the event of a crash landing. This airplane was remotely taken off, flown around the pattern several times, auto landed before they intentionally crash landed, and they got camera video of the impact damage to the passengers on a video that we have there. But now you jump ahead to the mid 90s, This is where we contend and we can prove that this system called the uninterruptible autopilot was developed. Now, there's a Wikipedia article. You can go ahead and Google uninterruptible autopilot or Boeing Honeywell uninterruptible autopilot, and you'll get a Wikipedia article that acknowledges that the system exists, but the Wikipedia article is misleading because it claims Boeing patented it in 2006.
Well, of course.
True. We have that patent on it. It says exactly what the autopilot will do and what the airplane will do, but they claim it was never been fitted with on commercial airlines. Well, of course, they're not going to admit that.
Well, but look at this, Captain Dan. Conspiracy theorists have claimed that the technology has been secretly fitted to some commercial airliners.
Right, that's what I claim. And you can go beyond this to Malaysia 370 and Malaysia 11, and those the disappearing or what happened to those two Boeing 777 aircraft. And in our reports to the FAA and the Department of Justice, we include those aircraft plus the Russian Metrojet that disappeared over that crashed over the Sinai. So it's all tied together. And what we've got on the first video at the bottom of the page is an interview. It's an audio interview of an avionics technician named Wayne Anderson, who actually worked on the system in the mid-1990s, 96 and 97. And what they did was bring a Boeing 757 into a hangar, and they were bench testing the autopilot system. And a gentleman with a laptop and maintenance control took control of the aircraft, and they couldn't disconnect the system. The guy in maintenance control could make the aircraft autopilot do whatever he was commanding it to do. So that's just, and we've got a couple other videos down there that back up what we're saying. So please go to the website. At the top of the page, you've got an About Dan Hanley, tells about me. I've done a couple of interviews in Malaysia, down on the bottom, and an affidavit that details my medical grounding. We've got a Join Us page up there as well. And it's very simple to join us, and we'll put you on our email list. All you need to do is give us your name, email address, and there's a comments box down there. And I want to emphasize that if you're a pilot and would like to be interviewed, please indicate that comments box, and I'll contact you personally by phone, and we'll set that up for you. So, and finally, we're not money grubbers. We do have a donate button I was reluctant to put on, but we do have overhead costs at 911pilots.org, such as website maintenance, our mailing system, and other things. And we're creating a documentary I can mention in a minute. So any excess donations we receive above our operating expenses for the organization, we donate to we're a not-for-profit organization. We do donated to nonprofit 9/11 whistleblower organizations such as the Lawyers Committee and the Architects and Engineers. So any donations you can give, however small, is appreciated. And finally, I mentioned we have a documentary we just filmed here in Islamabad. And it's going to cover everything I just discussed and more. And we had a kind woman in London go out with a GoFundMe, and we collected some money for the filming of the documentary because we hired a professional company to do it with us. And we collected some money there, but any donations we can get would be appreciated. And finally, I've written a book. I co-authored a book the last 2 years, and I found a publisher in Lahore, Pakistan, who's going to publish it for me. So that's it in a nutshell, what 911pilots.org is all about. My opinions on what occurred there. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Dan Hanley 4, that's H-A-N-L-E-Y 4, or on LinkedIn, I'm Captain Dan Hanley. So I know I've been talking a lot, but I had a lot to say. I was wondering, Aziza, do you have any questions, or Taronda, do you?
Taronda, you can go first. I have a couple of questions, but Taronda, go ahead.
Well, you know, honestly, when it first happened, I remember I was at work, and I worked for a government agency, so we had to leave immediately that day. So they literally dismissed us. And, you know, to everybody must go home until further notice. And when we were watching it, it was. You know, it was always puzzling, like any. It didn't ever sound right, you know. And then you started to see a lot of people. It was a lot of information that was coming out. That was, I think, was the true information. And all of a sudden, after about a couple weeks, that information just disappeared. So I don't know if they contacted those people, telling them, you better be quiet, don't say anything else, you know, about the situation. But just from the beginning, it was like something's not looking right. It just didn't sound right.
50% of Americans don't believe the official story, but they don't even know exactly what it is they don't believe about. And that's where us and other whistleblowers are coming in and trying to educate the public. And yeah, you don't believe it. Well, look at these facts that are out there that substantiate our claims that the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition, that the pilots couldn't have flown the airplane. So that's what we're trying to do, is educate the public. But we're up against the mainstream media, who calls us a bunch of whacked out conspiracy freaks. So that's what we're fighting, trying to educate the public with books. And then I'll point out, you say people remain silent about it. Well, there was a United Airlines Boeing 767 captain named Philip Marshall, who had written two books on 9/11 and was about to publish his third book, when they found his family dog and two teenage kids shot to death and him with a bullet in his head, and the police ruled it a murder-suicide. So there's been a lot of people that die as a result of trying to expose the lies of 9/11. Too many people are afraid to speak up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I believe that. I definitely believe that, because just what you went through just off the bat, you know, and I didn't know if they were going to say, okay, we're going to find this man crazy so he's not ever able to ever speak again. You know, I believe that. Now you're in an institution. Nobody wants that. So just like, you know, I'm just going to leave it alone. But my thing is, too, is if somebody was to ask you, okay, this happened, but a lot of people's going to ask, why? Why would they do this? Why would they, you know, of course, we know it's always collateral damage with a lot of things, but why would they do this? What did they have to gain in doing this?
Destabilization of every government in the Middle East to implement the Greater Israel Project. Make a lot of money for a lot of people. There was a lot of money made off 9/11.
Okay.
And I mentioned Israel and the United States, and that's just me speculating based on information I have. I could bring up people like Larry Silverstein or Michael Chertoff.
Or Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, exactly. So you could, there's a lot of people in a lot of countries and a lot of very powerful people that were involved in 9/11. And they each had different motives for wanting to do it. But with the exception of former Malaysian Prime Minister Mohamed Mahathir, who spoke out. I mean, he came right out and said Jews did 9/11. That was a little bit harsh. But he spoke out. A former Prime Minister of Italy spoke out. But everyone else is silent. And I'll admit, who was most harmed by 9/11? The Muslim community. And I'm disappointed that more Muslim leaders haven't spoken out. I mean, the facts are out there, but they're afraid to. Instead, you have some groups saying, mea culpa, we're so sorry this happened. We apologize. We weren't responsible. But no one's coming out and saying, no, the story stinks. And that disappoints me.
Well, that would be too much right for somebody to come out and, you know, apologize, and it would. But, you know, we were hearing before, and this is a few years, like after it happened, it was a gentleman talking about it, and his notion was that, and I know he had worked for the government as well, and he said, you know, he said three letters. His thing was because of oil, the control of the oil.
Well.
And I don't know.
That was part of it. That was part of it. I mean, Saddam Hussein had nationalized the oil industry, and they wanted to, and you look at who controls the oil in Iraq right now. When you look at Afghanistan and why they invaded it, I contend there were five reasons. One was the Tapi gas pipeline that runs from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan, through Pakistan into India. Okay, that was a point of contention. The second was the poppy field. The third is about $3 trillion worth of mineral, lithium, and other precious minerals in the ground in Afghanistan. And the fourth was to thwart Russian and Chinese expansion, westward expansion in South Asia. So those are reasons that I have surmised were the cause of the invasion of Afghanistan, and it had nothing to do with finding bin Laden.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It was taken to prevent China and Russian influence in the area, and it's still the case there today. And Iraq, you got to go back. There was a neocon Zionist think tank in Washington, D.C. called the Project for a New American Century. Have either one of you heard of that before?
Yes, PNAC.
Yeah, okay, PNAC, right? Well, for people that aren't aware of that, in 1998, this organization wrote then-President Bill Clinton a letter pleading with him to invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam Hussein. And 5 years later, they got their wish, the same organization. In the year 2000, exactly one year prior to 9/11, an individual named Dov Zakheim, who is a dual U.S.-Israeli Zionist who has been in the Defense Department since the Reagan era, co-authored a paper called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and I don't remember the subtitle to it, but the paper essentially called for the need for a new Pearl Harbor to garner public support for future defense spending and future wars. Well, 1 year later, they Pearl Harbor. So he's a key suspect because Dov was the CEO of a company called Planning Research Corporation, who developed a system called the Flight Termination System that enables a remote source to take control of an airborne vehicle and remotely guide it. An example being a missile test where the missile misfires and they don't want it to fall in a populated area, so they guide it away and need to blow it up or parachute the vehicle down, okay? So if you look at this Flight Termination, there's a woman named Rebecca Roth that's written 3 books, the Methodical series, Methodical Illusion, Methodical Deception, and Methodical Conclusion. She goes into great detail on Dov Zakheim because mysteriously, miraculously, Bush appoints him as comptroller to the Pentagon 4 months before 9/11, where he oversaw the Office of Budget Analysis, which was located within located in the area where American Flight 77 hit, where it killed over 30 auditors of the 50 auditors that were conducting an investigation in the mysterious disappearance of $2.3 trillion from the Pentagon budget. So he's one of the suspects. The other one being Michael Chertoff, another dual U.S. Israeli citizen who I had heard his mother was a Mossad agent. He was the assistant attorney general at the criminal division in the Justice Department. And he was the one that ordered the entire area cordoned off of this biggest crime scene in American history. No forensic evidence taken from the crime site, and ordered the steel to be hauled off to China at below market rates and sold. So he went on to become the second Department of Homeland Security secretary before he retired and went to work for a company called Rapiscan as a consultant. That this company developed those scanning X-ray scanning machines that you see at airports. So he made a lot of money off that as well. It all stinks. It's all corrupt. But yeah. I covered my three major: Larry Silverstein, Dov Zakheim, and Michael Chertoff are three key suspects. And if these grand jury investigations were to move forward, which I don't hold out much hope for because the system is so corrupt, the jurists have super subpoena power. They can ask the U.S. attorney to subpoena anyone before them for questioning that they want. And I would hope that those three individuals were brought before the grand jury to answer some questions on what happened that day.
Yeah, don't hold your breath on that, Captain Dan. But
I'm not holding my breath on that or the FAA DOJ investigation I'm trying to force because I know the system's so corrupt.
Right.
But I'm going to run the full gamut anyhow, and I got the backing of a lot of people.
Well, why not? I mean, I did want to ask you briefly about Flight 93, because that one has always stuck out to me like a sore thumb. There's no way they were calling family members, you know, 30,000 feet in the air. So can you go into that? Because
there's no way there were what? I didn't.
I said there's no way they were calling family members. You know, there was no capability of using a cell phone.
Because
they were like calling saying, I love you.
Cell phone calls and help.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think that was?
Rebecca Roth, in her book that I just mentioned, has this belief that there was an airborne swap of aircraft over Stewart Air Force Base, and the aircraft were remotely guided to Westover Air Force Base up in New England, and were forced to make cell phone calls on the ground before the passengers were snuffed. But I can't prove that. She has reasons to believe that's the case, but she's got a wealth of information. This woman was an American flight attendant, retired to start writing these books when she started questioning 9/11, and I chatted with her for a while on Facebook, and I can prove, just based on what she talked to me about, that she is legitimately a flight attendant, because some people out there say she's a fraud, okay? But she told me that once she started writing these books, she had pilots, FBI, CIA, air traffic controllers, maintenance people, everybody come rushing in with this wealth of information. So I personally haven't read the books. I've read excerpts from and watched some interviews of her. But that's what she claimed happened, that they were forced to make phone calls on the ground because it was impossible to make them in altitude on September 11th.
And, you know, just to add to that,
Go ahead.
I think we have a little delay. I'm sorry about that. What? Go ahead.
No, I was telling you, go ahead. You were going to say something.
Okay. No, I was just going to say that people may hear that, you know, supposedly that they were forced to make phone calls. Oh, how is that kind of conspiracy possible? It's easy to pay people off or strike fear into them enough where they will remain silent for years.
Right. Right.
So, yeah.
Well, people tell me, you can have a big mouth because you're living in Pakistan, 8,000 miles away from the United States, but nothing could be further from the truth. Pakistan's a relatively poor country, and I was told it only cost about $50 to have somebody killed over here, and this place is swarming with CIA, Mossad, MI6, FSB, RAW,
right.
You name it. So if they, I tell them the reason I don't consider myself a threat yet, because I'm still alive. If they wanted me dead, they'd kill me.
Yeah,
so yeah, absolutely. I will tell you that this is the first program I've done in the Middle East. I've done others around the world, but I would hope that if anyone listening to this that has a podcast or radio or TV program online would want to contact me, go to that 911pilots.org website, join us, and put a comment in there that you'd like to interview me, and I'll contact you. So
I will definitely spread this far and wide. Did you have any closing comments? Because I don't want to keep you too long. Because I know if we have three more people on here, our time is limited.
Yeah. Well, no, I just want to thank you for having me on. I'm sorry I talked so much, but we had a lot of material to cover, and I had a lot of things I wanted to say.
No, it was great.
I got to say it. So thank you for that. And it was nice meeting you both.
Nice meeting you, and thank you, yes.
Yeah. Sorry I didn't give you time for more questions.
No, it was a lot of information. I mean, it's... I mean, I enjoyed it. Well, I mean, something that you knew, but it's just like, wow. It just really opens it up now. Like, okay, now all the puzzles are basically coming together.
Yes. So anyhow, I'll close with that, Aziza. And thanks again for having me on.
Thank you, Captain.
Early in the morning here in Islamabad, so I guess I'll go.
What time is it there in Islamabad?
Hold on, I got to look at my clock. It's 2:14. I'm 4 hours ahead of you.
Oh, okay.
Well, I won't keep you because you need to get some rest. So, but we'll be in touch, inshallah. I really appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you like what you've just heard, subscribe to Tune In Weekly for new episodes. You have something to say, or would you like to be featured as a guest? Shoot me an email at hottwithaziza@gmail.com or follow me on Instagram at hot_t_aziza. Until next time, be blessed and be well.